We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I didn't even read the about section. I just saw that there were some cats and some movies, and I clicked interested.
So you're a cat guy?
I'm an animal person. I like animals much more than I like humans. And yeah, well, I like domesticated animals who don't talk back. And because of my lifestyle, I don't have time for a dog. So I have a cat.
We're talking about all cats?
Like
lions?
I would say that because I tend to like the best of whatever it is I'm into, then yes, I like lions because they are the apex predator. They're the apex of the cat world.
Okay. What did you think about Lion King?
I actually didn't see Lion King. I know several of the songs from the movie, but I've never seen the movie itself.
That's the only movie I've ever cried at.
I cried at The Fox and the Hound.
Is that true?
Yeah, and that and The Notebook. Okay. We're here with John Clark, black belt, Sean Fisher, black belt, Boston. You guys, are you a true Bostonian or no?
No, I'm not. I'm from Connecticut. I've lived in lots of different places, and I wound up here probably 10 years ago. I'm doing my best to discover things about Boston that are going to endear me to the city and vice versa.
And how's that going?
It's not going too bad. I'm definitely doing things that I normally don't do, which is pretty cool. So,
like what?
I don't know like anything about art, but on Friday I went to the MFA, the Museum of Fine Art, had like a late night thing where they were showing like contrasting styles of Japanese art, kind of like traditional woodblock art and then new school Japanese art. And they had beer and food and
DJs. What's new school Japanese art?
You know, I won't do it justice, but at the risk of sounding stereotypical, to me it all looked like Hello Kitty shit.
Yeah, right. So is it like modern art? Does it still make sense? It's still so if Hello Kitty makes sense.
Yeah, it was the colors and shapes. There were lots of like just circular flower shapes. And again, I don't even have the vocabulary to do it justice. Right. But it was very high gloss, laminated, bright, colorful stuff, contrasting with the Japanese woodblock, the traditional type stuff that you might see if you just Googled like Japanese art.
I'm kind of impressed right now. So for people that there's no video, so I'm sitting across somebody you would probably find in like your scariest nightmare in prison and be like, oh shit, I have to deal with that guy. Tattooed, manly, and he's talking. We started talking about cats and Japanese, the difference between modern and classical Japanese art is...
And I probably did not do it justice at all. It's just what I observed.
And you're apologetic about not doing it justice.
He's a Renaissance
man. All right.
And I was a philosophy major to start with. And then I did have a chance to do it all over again. And I did do it all over again.
And if you had a chance to do that all over again, would you make any changes?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I would. I think that there were a number of things that I learned in my course of undergraduate study that have helped me on the path that I was on to get to this point in my life that you use in a non-traditional manner. So I didn't take my education, put it on a resume, and then go and try and find a job that paid me for what I learned in college. But what I started to do with my life, I was able to draw little nuggets from my education and then use them to help along the way, which is a little bit, you're still using your education, but it's not like, oh, I'm going to be a psych major and I'm going to go be a psychologist.
Right.
You know, I studied communication with an emphasis on organizational communication. I don't even know what the hell people do with that, but certain aspects of it have certainly helped me along the way in various endeavors.
Yeah, communication. It makes you like that's like a it seems like one of those like leadership skills.
Could be foundational to many.
And it was endeavors. And they're like when through the course of study, like you study a lot of things. You know, you study different clinical models of how people in different settings communicate with each other. Like one of the course studies, was relational communication, which I always just called like poor man's psychology. And so it talks about, you know, you're learning about how people communicate with each other and stuff. And really all it does is it teaches you what an asshole you are. I already had some indication that I was an asshole.
Yeah. What kind of asshole were you? So let's take this, the evolution of the asshole.
I would say that it just shows you how your communication style and the things you say to people in any interpersonal relationship, they really reflect what type of person you are, like how selfish you are, the words you choose. It's a good indication of how selfish you are, what you want out of that relationship, because everybody wants something out of a relationship. The whole thing's transactional. And when you get to examine, kind of like when you learn communication styles of different people and what that means, you can take a flashlight into your soul and kind of like see a little bit about who you are.
It's a dark way to look at relationships, that everybody needs something from the relationship.
Yes.
So why did I ask you to come here for a podcast? What do I want from you?
Well, I mean, here we are sitting here, and I will bet you dollars to donuts that we have some good laughs today.
That's
and
true.
So at the very minimum, that's a transaction. We came over here and we're all going to – if we have a good, few good chuckles, we've gained.
Right.
We come out of this on the plus side, depending on what other options you had to do with this time. So this time is only as valuable as its alternate uses.
Okay. You started first discovering what kind of asshole you are. What kind of asshole are you – after that, after the communications?
After I became just a much more aware asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what kind of asshole are you today? What are you working on?
I'm not really working on anything anymore, because I think I'm at the age where I'm pretty self-aware and I'm comfortable being like, hey, this is me, take it or leave it.
Right.
But, and I think that like you learn certain things about yourself, like for the most part, I'm a selfish individual. That's probably my biggest problem, is that I want to do what I want to do. And I don't care.
Right.
But I'm also like, I'm comfortable just doing what I want to do by myself. I'm not into forcing others to do things that I want to do, but I'm probably not going to go along for the ride with anyone else that I don't want to.
Right. So you're happily married, I assume then?
No.
So philosophy. Why philosophy? Why'd you major philosophy?
I originally majored in philosophy because I thought that for sure I would do that, and then I would go on to law school and be a lawyer.
And you get disillusioned by the idea of being a lawyer?
I did some research at some point when I was – well, first of all, I had to change schools because I had – my first attempt at college was it interfered with my social agenda, so to speak, and it wasn't conducive to the other activities I was pursuing in college. So I didn't – you can't excel in everything at once, and I really wanted to excel socially.
Yeah. Can you get into the details? I'll edit all this out. I just can't get into the details.
You
of
don't
the
have
social-
to. I would say that it's difficult to be productive in the classroom when you spend the – night prior trying to break keg stand records.
Oh, so what's the weapon of choice? Beer? So
yes.
Beer, straight up beer.
Straight up. I'm a beer guy for the most part, yeah.
Okay. So we're in Cambridge now. Are you like a Bud Light?
It depends PBR? On the evening. It depends on if I can forecast the longevity of the event, it will go a long way towards dictating what I drink.
Hmm.
Yeah,
so if
situational.
Situational.
Yeah.
If I whatever I consume all of it, no matter what. So if I sit down for dinner, I'll probably drink 8 Diet Cokes or 8 waters or a half a gallon of milk.
Right.
So I'm constantly eating and drinking. So I know that if we're going to be out for a long time, I can't be drinking 9%, you know, triple box all night. That you find in Cambridge, right?
Wow, you're a planning guy then. So you don't. When was the last time you were blackout drunk?
It's been that's been probably a little while.
Have you ever lost control when drunk? Like not lost control. So there's levels. So
do you have a bigger couch? Because we're gonna start talking about this. Yeah. I should probably lay down.
No, I mean, in Russia, there's a big thing that you should never lose control when you're trash, no matter how much you drink. And of course, it's a caricature of reality because you do eventually lose control. But it's such a matter of pride to have a straight face and be collected for as long as possible. That's where that question is.
I think when people drink, the minute, and it's different for everyone, the minute you're technically, and I don't even know what this means, but the minute you begin to be inebriated, there's a level of lost control. So it's a spectrum.
Yeah. So you mean like intellectual loss of control? Like you're
that's how it starts.
Right. Or the person who makes the comment they never would have made before, you know,
lowered inhibitions.
Yeah.
Do you know what you're like drunk? Because I
me personally,
yeah, because like I've watched footage of myself doing several things. Like, well, no, not drunk. Like compete, for example.
Right.
And then you look a lot worse than you thought you did.
Yeah, you always think you're faster and smoother and whatever.
And when I'm drunk, I think I'm I'm a player for sure in my mind, and I'm also one of the world's like. Probably one of the toughest, best fighters ever. But, like, I don't have any footage of what that actually is.
On those,
Yeah, probably. I mean, I enjoy that because I'm pretty scared of everything when I'm sober. Mm. Like, I'm aware of my fears and just confrontation. Yeah. I'm an introvert. I'm a true introvert.
So I'm an extrovert, I think, for the most part. And because...
Sober.
Yeah. Yeah. And because, again... I might be totally wrong on this, but I consider my strength to be self-awareness. And and so when I do stupid stuff and that people think is stupid, I know I'm doing it.
Right.
It's not a mistake.
You're enjoying the art that you're creating.
I'm enjoying the independence of just acting the way I want to act and not giving a fuck what anybody says.
Yeah.
And saying – and the ability to just be like – yeah, this is what it is. Sorry. Like, I generally try not to hurt anybody else unless they deserve it. So, like, through my, you know, being kind of, like, crass and, like, brutally honest with people and things like that, you know, I don't see that as hurting anyone.
Oh, the intention is love and there's a respect underlying you telling.
I think the intention is to not compromise myself.
Yeah.
That's my intention when I'm honest with people.
Principle.
Right. You can be honest with people without being like an asshole to them.
Yeah.
But the thing for me is like, you like to do it in a way that doesn't compromise myself. The greatest example I have is when students come in the gym and it mostly happens with MMA and they tell you all these great lofty things that they want to do. And that's great. And you kind of give them, you know, a little bit of a peek inside of what you think it could be like the process. And then after like a month or so, there are instructors who will tell students, yes, you can achieve X, Y, and Z. And a lot of it is motivated by the instructor's need or want for the tuition from that student. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm perfectly happy not taking their money and saying, it's not in the cards for you. You just don't have it. There's no amount of hard work that's going to get you to where you think you want to be. There is an amount of hard work that can get you somewhere where you might be happy. But for you to walk in here and tell me that you think you're going to be the UFC champion at 185 pounds, I don't see it happening.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed with your gym is you seem to have less care than others in compromising for tuition. I believe in loyalty and like... A lot of instructors talk about loyalty. It always feels to me like part business discussion.
I think the loyalty in the jiu-jitsu community is a term that's it's very much bandied about, and I don't think people have any under idea really that it's just kind of like a catch-all. Oh, loyalty, my gym, my guys, right. My instructor.
I think people misuse and right. Overuse it to almost a
loyalty is a two-way street, and this is how I look at it. No matter what you're doing or buying or purchasing, whatever, like you can come to my gym and you can pay your $100 and whatever a month to do your jiu-jitsu training. And if you want to go and also train at another gym, I don't give a fuck because, you know, you're a consumer. Right. And as long as I hold up my end of the bargain and I provide for you $129 worth of value that month, our transaction is complete. Now, when you start to come into my gym and you say, oh, do you need help with the beginner's class? Let me take these first day guys over here and you start showing them hip escapes. Right now, the value is not symmetrical. So right now, I'm actually getting $129 and you're helping me. teach these guys. So I have to do something above and beyond. I have to show you greater value.
Right.
So sometimes for me, it's like students don't understand a lot of times, like a perceived level of value. So like I'll take a bunch of brand new guys, they pay $129 and then they're going to go to a tournament. And let's say I drive them to the tournament. Let's say I pay for their lunch, you know, on the way to the tournament. Let's say I stay late after class and I give them things that are not necessarily included in their $129 tuition. Okay. And let's say they have access to great other competitors on the mat, like Sean and Chris and mm-hmm. Cape and yourself. And mm-hmm. they get to, you know, pick people's brains for free, which back in the day would have been a private lesson that you had mm-hmm. to pay for. Now they're getting more value than they're paying for.
Right.
And now we have to establish like a line of loyalty. The people who I see always fall into this like beef with their instructors about loyalty and this and that and the other thing are generally takers. They're generally people who are trying to take more than they're paying for anyway. Mm-hmm. And then when that stops, they see it as some sort of like disrespect from their instructor. Mm-hmm. And so those are the people that I generally see that happen with. And I don't know that that's true because I don't have any empirical evidence. It's just years in the community.
It's just a misuse of the term.
And you're right. It's a misuse of the term because a lot of instructors, they call like disloyalty or whatever, however you want to say it. What they're doing is they're masking their insecurity. So what they're saying is you're mm-hmm. not being loyal to me by going and training at another gym. But what they mean is I'm afraid you're going to go to that gym and see something better than what you see here. Right. And then you're going to go and give that guy your $129 a month.
But isn't there also a deeper thing? Like, I mean, your life, it's such a big part of your life is being an instructor, and some of your deepest relationships are with the students.
And they're organic.
Yeah, but it's not about loyalty or whatever. It's almost like in a relationship when you get jealous. It's not like – it's almost like I thought we had something. Like, so there's that kind of – you see that in wrestling. There's these deep, deep relationships at the collegiate level with the coach.
Remember when I told you that I learned about myself that I'm an asshole?
Yeah.
That's part of my asshole like personality makeup is that – my whole thing in terms of like the jealousy is that, first of all, if you want your cows to come home, you don't keep them locked in a pen. You let them graze. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and if you're going to use a relationship analogy, the quickest way, can we say whatever we want on here?
Not on that topic. No, okay. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
The quickest way yeah, to have your girlfriend go and give a Johnny Football a blowjob mm-hmm. is to tell her she can't go talk to Johnny Football.
Right.
That's the fastest route to getting her to do the exact thing you don't want her to do. So when you just act like it's nonchalant or you're confident enough that she's not going to do it, maybe she won't do it. But, you know, she's the type of person who'll do it anyway. There's nothing you can do or say that'll stop it. So you mm-hmm. might as well at least, you know, be aware. And if she wants to go give that guy a blowjob or if your student wants to go and leave and go train somewhere else, you just have to let them and you let them go and it doesn't matter. And you have to have enough confidence in what you're doing to know that either her seat's not going to get cold or she's going to come back around in the long run anyway because she'll realize what she fucked up. She or he, the student or the girlfriend.
Okay. How do I put it? The ability to hang out with Johnny Football and the possibility of blowjobs would does something to your mind over time. It's choice. Like it's like saying that an Iowa guy, so an Iowa wrestler could, yeah, it makes total sense to go wrestle in Oklahoma. Like, to train a little bit, you know, cause to see what off season, what that's like. But at the same time, that does something wrong to the mind. Like allowing that even possibility. It's almost good to be unhealthily possessive. Not perhaps in relationships, although most Russian guys are, mm-hmm. but but in terms of coaching,
they
play a little devil's advocate, I suppose.
I feel like the stereotypical like loyalty issues in jiu-jitsu, like they're my feelings would be hurt if a student that I valued left me because of a personal issue. But if a student of mine that I valued left me because he said, I just can't get what I need anymore from you, I have to take a more academic approach to that. And then mm-hmm. what I have to say is, all right, I value you. And if you really believe this, you need to go get what you need from someone else, because this is a, you know, this part's about you. And also it provides me with a jump off to look a little bit inward and say, why are you not getting that stuff from me? And what can I do differently to make sure that all my other students are getting that?
Wow. Yeah. You're very balanced and healthy in your wise old age. It's good to see.
Yeah.
Are you a football fan?
I am a football fan.
Even though you're a participant and a fan and a coach of a like an actual sport?
Yeah, I was a football fan my whole life and played football, you know, my whole life. And I don't like – my interest in football is waning with new rules, the way the sport has evolved. It's just – it's a lot less entertaining for me now. And I've also found that, and this could be a constant, and maybe I'm just becoming more aware, but the culture of football fandom is very off-putting to me. Like, I don't believe, like, no man should walk around wearing another man's name on his back and celebrating him for doing great things. And instead, like, you should be out trying to do your own great things instead of sitting there, like, chugging, like, you know, margaritas and stuffing your face, like, wishing you were someone else.
Wow, you just described most of my 20s. Okay. Down to the margaritas. Daiquiri sometimes. That's interesting. So you're not a fan of
I'm not heroes. A fan of the fans.
What about hero? I mean, the idea of a hero that the athlete at the top of their sport represents.
There's an entirely different thing when you have someone that you, and I don't even know what the right words are. There are heroes, there are mentors, there are inspirations. When there's something that you can, someone who's achieved something great that you can model your life after and get close to that or be something great in your own right or in your own field or pursuit or whatever, that's a different relationship than someone like, you know, when I'm walking down the streets of South Boston and I see, you know, a little fat drunk guy with a Gronkowski jersey on, you're never going to be Gronkowski. You're never even going to play football. And so that type of like fanboy hero dumb worship, that to me is, I don't like that. I feel like you need to start to look in the mirror.
I feel like the problem isn't the fandom, it's the person. So you would have that problem with that person, whether they were wearing a jersey or not.
Probably.
So I feel like you're identifying the problem. You're placing the problem into, okay, no, you started as saying it represents a culture that you're not a fan of.
And a great example of it is when we started, you know, and we had a very modest MMA program at Broadway Jiu-Jitsu. We had a bunch of guys.
Nice plug.
Thank you. We had a... It's 36 West Broadway. We had a bunch of guys who fought at 145 pounds. And this is about the time Conor McGregor was really like becoming well known for his antics. And he was in Boston doing a press thing before one of the fights. And a bunch of the 145 pound guys were going to have access through the community to like basically go and worship Conor in his face as opposed to worshiping Conor from their couches. And they all started to get together. And one of my students, and back, you're talking, they're all like, you know, 2-0 and pros at this point. One of my students said, "What the fuck do I want to go and kiss Conor McGregor's ass for? That's going to be my opponent one day." And that student has now gone on and he's in the UFC. Mm-hmm. And I believe that attitude is really something that drove him. And he didn't want to, he didn't look at himself. And I think the hero worship game assigns you a certain role, right? And when you are looking up to someone to emulate them, you're not assigned a role. The hero worship game keeps you at a level like that's almost like somehow inferior to that person. Whereas a mentorship or something like that, it's guiding you to surpass that inferior level and kind of achieve greater
right things. So but here's the thing,
does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, but I disagree with you on one. So first of all, one way we know each other is you lost $20 to me in a Conor McGregor Nick Diaz fight.
Did I?
Yeah, I do.
But did I pay you?
Yeah, you did. Okay. right there. I was gonna bet you again on the Mayweather McGregor fight. Like an even 20 was like a pity 20 to throw back at you.
I appreciate that.
But anyway, I'm a fan of Conor McGregor, and in the same disgusting way that you think that you were just describing. But that's because I'm not trying to be in the UFC. I am inspired by the guy in what I do in other pursuits in life.
I think there, like, without a doubt, there are people that I am humongous fans of. In the jiu-jitsu community, I'm a gigantic Roger Gracie guy. Right. But I'm not a Roger Gracie guy that is going to like run up to him and ask for a picture to put on my Instagram so that people can, you know, press likes. I'm a Roger Gracie fan in that I think he does things exceptionally well. and I want to figure out how he does them so that I can do them
right.
And elevate myself. There are people who I'm fans of who are outside of this, the world in which I make my living. And I kind of look at it the same way. What did they do to get, they're awesome at something. Someone's awesome. Someone has achieved this unbelievable level of something, but I want to know how did they achieve it? How did they get there? And how can I adapt that to what I'm about?
And you just don't want to, through that whole process, wear their name on your back.
I think it's like the level of hero worship by some people, it like assigns themselves a permanent inferiority.
Yeah, I agree. It contextualizes yourself as being in that like
right.
hierarchy. That guy's up there. It's like you assign what he's been able to achieve almost like supernatural qualities rather than thinking that that guy got to that point through some like combination of intelligence and hard work and like figuring stuff out and trying to get good at whatever his craft is.
So you're saying every single person, no matter where they're in life, should always be striving to be at some like high level.
I think there is a difference between ultimate performance and optimal performance. I've been reading.
I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
I'm reading this fucking awesome book right now, and I just stole it. It's called The Rise of Superman. It's like about deconstructing human potential, and it's really cool. I think that like people should be striving to be the best at whatever it is they're pursuing, and it doesn't matter what it is. Like, I think if what you want to do is be good at jiu-jitsu, then you owe it to yourself to try and find out exactly how good you can be. But if what you want to do is join a gym and wear a t-shirt and tell everybody you're a badass when the UFC's on at Buffalo fucking Wild Wings, then that's a whole nother thing. And you need to be honest with yourself. Like, when there's a pursuit, I think like you owe it to yourself to be honest about how good you want to, how much you want to dedicate to that pursuit. A really good like analogy, and it has a lot of relevance right now, is Joe Rogan in the jiu-jitsu community. I mean, I think Joe Rogan's great. I think Joe Rogan is an interesting guy. He has some really cool topics that he talks about. I think it's great the way he's parlayed his careers together to kind of like follow the UFC events and do comedy shows the night before, and he gets all these dope-ass guys to be on his podcast and stuff. But in the jiu-jitsu community, there are people that, for lack of a better term, like if Joe Rogan were in the room, they'd get right on their knees and unzip his pants for no other reason than he's right. Joe Rogan. That's and right. I'm like, you know, that level of assigning yourself permanent inferiority, that's what bugs me.
Yep. We're going to do something, okay? I don't like what's going on. I actually brought you here to make sexual advances on your show.
I figured as much.
Can you come and sit where I'm sitting?
Yeah, sure.
And then we're gonna do a love seat together.
So
we call the love seat.
So, Lex, you are obviously now taking cues from Harvey Weinstein, the greatest assaulter of our time.
Oh yeah. Which I actually didn't know anything about. I learned about him listening to Joe Rogan's podcast with some other Weinstein.
Yeah.
Just recently.
Yeah.
It was really good. What was he? He's like an economics guy?
Yeah, I listened to part of that. It was like economics and I don't know if he's math or something
else. He said, I actually wrote this as like one of the topics, so it like blew my mind. He was talking about the difference, the Google memo and the difference between women and men in the technical workforce. And he was saying that the really defining characteristic of men is they overpromise and overdeliver. So whenever you ask me, Lex, can you, are you going to compete in Nogi Worlds? My inclination is to say yes, first of all, and then to say that I'm going to win. So like it's just like the it's an overpromise. It's overpromise on many dimensions, and then be forced to struggle with the fact that I am not there, and I have to work my ass off to get there. And so like struggle through that and actually try to make that happen. So that's how like because he's saying to accomplish anything in life, you have to overpromise. You have to do more than you think you're capable of.
Right, right.
And so what
otherwise women, you wouldn't grow right. ever, right?
Yeah. And so what women do is they technical disciplines at least, are more, they actually say exactly what they will be able to deliver. So they're actually not bullshit.
They're like more guys, accurate about what they...
So guys bullshit, and then they're like, oh shit, now I have to actually do this.
Right.
So where women is more honest, and they actually have a good estimate of what they're able to do, and because they compete with guys on the... on. And the guys constantly bullshit and overpromise. Guys win out and actually sometimes actually make it happen.
Right,
which is
right.
This weird like
it's like world. A self-fulfilling prophecy when you project the
well,
goal.
It's like you made
much.
A contract with yourself in some way or with yeah. whoever you told. Like, and now it's like, oh, I'm actually going to have to try and you know fulfill this.
Right.
And through running your mouth, you might actually find out that you can do that.
Right. But then I think that maybe like statistically over a big population that holds, but people are not in general. Men are not like I don't like so many people talk a bunch and then they don't do literally any of the stuff that they say they're going to do.
Right, we see it in the gym every day.
Yeah, that's where.
But he says so. That's what like Rogan came after him a little bit on the because Rogan's like, well, that sounds like men bullshit. Because what Weinstein, whatever his name is, Eric Weinstein, was saying women need to bullshit more, overpromise more. And Brogan's like, no, that just sounds like you're asking women to bullshit more. But the reality is that culture is good. So there's a bunch of guys at the gym that might say overpromise and underdeliver.
Right.
But you have to first learn to overpromise. And then, okay. And that's where the winners start emerging. Like,
right.
All
so
the winners.
That's a cultural sort of way of. Like acting and communicating, there will be some group subset of people that do
actually
like do the work to get to the whatever the goal they set was or the thing they said they were going to do. Yeah.
I think also like when and obviously like this is what dominates my life. So a lot of my analogies are gym analogies. A lot of it is like people are buying themselves some temporary credibility when they say they're going to go to Nogi Worlds and win it. They're buying themselves like at that moment some temporary credibility and like. Just by merely announcing that they're going to do that, they think they've put themselves in the strata of the people that will do it. And then what they'll do to remove themselves from that strata is come up with an excuse as to why that didn't happen and think that that's okay. And then it's always like, so-and-so went to Worlds and got bronze. Well, I was going to go, but you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this is, if we could talk about the kind of assholes we are.
Yeah.
This is a huge problem for me. I notice my failings to be exact copies of the way I fail in jiu-jitsu is the same as I fail in the rest of my life. So it's not like you can fail in jiu-jitsu and then that's fine. It doesn't transfer. It does. It completely does. So quitting, saying like promising you're going to do something, even if it's as loose as saying to somebody, that's a huge failure that actually is contagious. And I find myself over-promising way too much. But then I'm like, I kill myself. To try to over-deliver, but when you overpromise so much that, like, you're constantly under-delivering, it becomes this weird, like, you're letting your mind quit too many times.
Right.
Right. It's almost like you want to pick specific over-promises and not,
be a little
not
more
across
selective.
The board. Yeah.
And I think, like, over-promising and under-delivering, as long as you can recognize it, I think it's important for people to... It's a self-education tool and it's like, what can you start to promise that you can deliver and things like that.
Right. Yeah. You have to first like see what's just out of your reach to like calibrate so you can figure out what's within your reach and then you get to that and then you go to the next one.
But that's a logical process. So when we talk about like, especially jiu-jitsu tournaments, like if I went right now to compete at Adult Worlds right now, right, at my age with my injuries and in my weight class that I'm in right now, logically I have to approach that and say, probably there's not a good chance for me to get on the podium.
Right.
It's probably not going to do that. But the emotional side of me, the competitive side, which is emotional,
yeah,
says there's no way I'm not winning this.
Right.
There's just no way I can't beat everyone in there. And the two, like, it's like they don't reconcile.
Yeah.
Because once you start training for that event, my emotions take over. I think I'm going to win. I believe that emotionally. But then when the logical side of me has to look objectively at it, you have to realize that's an unbelievably difficult task for me to accomplish.
Right.
And so I don't know if those two like thought processes coexist simultaneously, or if you're constantly flipping between one and the other at such a rapid pace that they might as well just exist simultaneously.
Hmm. Well, in that case, the logical is the one you shouldn't listen to, right?
Right.
It's like you should kind of deceive yourself sometimes in order to be better.
Right.
Then you
not even sometimes, almost.
Right. Yeah, like all the time.
Right. All the time.
Right.
Non-stop.
So yeah. The great example I always give people is that I went to a Roger Gracie camp a bunch of summers ago, and we went and we trained, and at the end of the camp, I got to roll with him a couple times, and it was as expected. You know, I was tortured, and I felt like I didn't even know what jiu-jitsu was, and I'd been doing it wrong for 15 years. And then as soon as I walked out of the building at the end of the camp and started packing my things up to get on the flight home, I thought the reason was I was being too respectful to Roger, and I didn't want to come across as a guy trying to take him out. And the camp happens once a year. And for the entire year, I thought, and I probably mentioned it to Sean a bunch of times, I can do much better than that against him. I know I can. I need to put some effort in, give it a little bit of thought, and probably I can beat him. Like, I've never won a major jiu-jitsu tournament, you know, at adult. I've won like small division events at Masters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I spent the year thinking I was going to go back there and defeat the greatest jiu-jitsu fighter of all time. And I believed it.
Yeah.
And I believed it. And I went back, Lex, and I rolled with him so many times a second time at the camp. And every time he just systematically dismantled me.
Yeah.
and narrated the process while I'm trying like my hardest. Like, it was so demeaning, but on the walk back from the gym to my hotel every night, I was like, actually, tomorrow I know what I need to fix, and I'm going to beat him.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a disease, I think, no, to an extent.
But you no doubt got better at jiu-jitsu from that process.
Right.
Had you just at the start gone, you slap hands with him, and in your head, your, you know, little John in your head goes, this guy's the greatest jiu-jitsu fighter of all time. I will have nothing for him.
Right.
You'll just wilt like a dead flower,
right,
and you, neither of you will, he's get anything out of it.
Yeah, he's just a man.
Yeah.
After my latest knee surgery, I started like swimming in the pool, and and I literally,
this is outrageous. What you're,
I literally,
what's
literally
your favorite stroke?
So I was doing freestyle, and I'd swim like a little bit, like as a kid, you know, summer camps and stuff like that, but I got in the pool and I started doing laps, and I had remembered a little bit of the form, and I literally got out of the pool and I started to research how fast Michael Phelps was swimming the exact same things I was, because I thought to myself, with a little coaching, I probably can beat him.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a little. Yeah. You're pretty tall. So.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And the emotional part of me, the competitive side of me, thinks, yes, that can happen. The other great example of how I can't understand like the thought process, and if they're two different things, you had a lecture on Facebook maybe,
mm-hmm,
of a class you were teaching at MIT. Yeah. I watched the lecture and I immediately either walked out and saw Sean or texted him and said, I have to go and find out more about this topic than Lex, so that I can be smarter than you about
exactly.
It. And it's not possible. It's not possible for me in a month.
Well, in this one case, I know it could be. I mean, no, quite honestly, I mean, I wonder what Hodger thinks about that. What does Hodger tell you, right? I mean, from his perspective, or Roger, whatever, from his perspective, how far away are you from him?
Mm, that's a good question. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Your thought process involving rolling with Roger is way more appropriate than the Phelps and the AI thing. Because that's just, you've never spent any time doing that. But yeah, I don't know
Phelps. I mean, how far away are you from Phelps? So, because I know, because there's some things I'm good at. Like, I'm good at building bridges from toothpicks.
Nice. That's a great skill.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I know that the people that are just starting with that are actually, it feels like they're really close. It makes me nervous how easy it is to get good at that.
This is what I think, that the better people get at something, the differences are it's deceiving how big the difference is, because it looks almost like the same thing. Because a tough blue belt comes into a gym who has wrestled before or something. Like, what he knows and could maybe teach someone about jiu-jitsu or anything is so much less than the highest level guys at the gym. But if that tough blue belt rolls with any of the highest level guys, he might survive for a bit, and he might only get tapped like once or twice or something, maybe doesn't get tapped at all. But there's still a giant, giant difference between those two guys. Though it doesn't look like,
right,
from an outside observer, even someone who's in the know might look at that and be like, oh, wow, that guy did really good against, XYZ.
It's the Good Will Hunting quote. There are only a few people in the world that can do this proof, and there are even fewer that can tell the difference among them.
Right, yeah. Right.
But it feels like what mastery is. I don't think I've achieved that at anything, but it feels like it's like simple.
Yeah.
It feels like it's super simple, so it's deceiving. Yeah, like with the bridge building. It's actually to build a good bridge, there's just like a few fundamentals to it. And you just do it. It's like super simple. And you say it to everybody else and they don't really do it.
Yeah.
They don't follow rules.
I think about this stuff all the time. With a lot of things, whatever the endeavor is, jiu-jitsu or bridges with toothpicks, you can probably articulate a handful of foundational techniques or practices or guidelines or whatever. But that the real masters, what they're really, really good at, are executing all of those at the same time, all the time. Where someone who's just like in the process of learning can maybe sometimes execute one of those simple things, but then they miss all the other simple things. And it's like a, I don't know. It's almost like you have to figure out how to execute all the simple things all at once, and it's way harder than it seems like it should be.
And I also think that I'll make a jiu-jitsu analogy. I don't even know what mastery is. What is mastery? I've been doing jiu-jitsu for so long, and there are so many cliches and like stupid little phrases that people put on Instagram and stuff as motivational things. Some of them are really true. Like the more jiu-jitsu I do, the more I learn how much I don't know.
Yeah.
There's so many things to learn.
What reveals to you that you don't know something?
Well, what reveals it? I mean, sadly, I bet you a lot of jiu-jitsu instructors don't have the luxury that I have of having Sean and Chris and Cape to sit there and discuss moves. And for all intents and purposes, be jiu-jitsu nerds about it. But nerds that aren't, there are jiu-jitsu nerds, and there are jiu-jitsu nerds who want to figure things out and figure out how to do them. And so take whatever the technique is that you think you're really good at. There's a way to do it better.
Yeah.
Someone's fixing it and making it better right now.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to say, all right, I've been doing kimuras for 15 fucking years. Someone's figuring out how to do it better. Yeah. I can't just rest on my laurels.
Yeah.
I've got to figure out, do the better way.
I feel like you constantly, like the global you, as you're trying to learn and get good at something, you're like constantly discovering a depth to techniques, for example, that maybe before you thought was more shallow. Like you think, okay, I get it. I get what a kimura is. You lock your hands this way and you put your weight this way and that's it. But there's like this like forever depth to all those techniques. And I feel like that's what a lot of mastery is about. People who start to understand and can articulate and teach to others the depth of those things.
And I think it the pursuit of mastery starts to happen when you study other things and try and apply those philosophies to the endeavor you're trying to master.
Yeah.
Almost everything I do, I'm like making a jiu-jitsu analogy or figuring out, can the ideas behind this pursuit make my jiu-jitsu better or the way that I teach jiu-jitsu better? Yeah. I try and play bass, and there are a lot of analogies in learning and teaching that you can use to make jiu-jitsu better and teaching my jiu-jitsu better personally. a few years ago, I was in Germany and I didn't know a whole lot about like the World War II and things like that. So while I was there, I started watching all these documentaries because I learned a few things and I was like, man, how did in one generation Germany go from being totally decimated to having this unbelievable like tank regiment? And like, I wanted to understand like what were the philosophies behind the armor generals and what were they doing to make those guys like their tank battalions so effective? And can I then apply that to jiu-jitsu? So it's like stuff like that, like that I wanted to understand, like this book, The Rise of Superman, like it's mostly about like extreme athletes, but I'm trying to figure out, are there ways to apply that to jiu-jitsu? So yeah, that's when I realized that like the mastery goes beyond locking your hands here and turning this way.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to pull ideas from all other areas of study and right, apply them.
But there's a luxury you have in jiu-jitsu actually, which is why jiu-jitsu is amazing, is you get to like, there's no speaking required for you to reveal your lack of mastery. So you roll with Sean and he'll submit you in some kind of way or do some kind of sweep. And that will reveal through that action to you that there's a lot more mm-hmm. to learn. And like in academia, yeah, there's a field called machine learning, for example, what I do. You know, I have so many people every day telling me that I'm like the world expert in this. Mm-hmm. That it's easy for me to walk around like those fake people on Facebook, the martial art, mm-hmm. like yeah, the black belts that just knock people out by just looking at them. Because there's no way to actually in the intellectual world to reveal lack of mastery.
Settle it. We can settle it.
How?
If I disagree that Sean in a level of mastery
in jiu-jitsu,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We have a very definitive way to settle it.
Yeah, the math doesn't lie. You can just...
And it's so beautiful. It's so few things in society and things we do have that.
Yeah, it's like that level of clarity of... Yeah.
So with that, the role of violence. I just wrote the role of violence. I feel like for some reason when I enter your gym...
topic.
Oh, it is.
I love violence. You're like
nodding with a smile.
Yeah. I feel like
I remember having a lady friend at the time. And like she went to like yoga upstairs,
mm-hmm.
and went downstairs. Like the first time I went to your gym, and I was like, "Oh shit!" There's a Hunter S. Thompson quote, whatever the fuck is on the. which one is it?
Now I'm gonna forget it. Or
yeah, now I'm gonna forget it.
It's not a standard.
For every moment of beauty, for every instance of glory, many souls must be trampled.
It's
along those lines.
It ends with many souls must be trampled.
Yeah.
I was like, oh shit, what did I get myself into? Because I started like walking downstairs.
I can't believe you don't have a huge kids program.
I mean, I remember like thinking, I think Hunter S. Thompson, oh cool.
Someone here can read.
Yeah. And then reading the quote was like, oh, that's going to be terrifying. So violence is what I felt I was entering into. So what's the role of violence in your life?
In my life? I mean, violence, I don't know how violence plays a role in my life other than I teach violence.
One of the things that came here to Cambridge, I live in Cambridge. And one of the things I felt, there's a complete lack of violence. It was a very surprising thing to me, like as a feeling.
So in there's no way to say this and sound anything but like an absolute, like total simian, which is...
I know what a simian is. You sound very smart.
It's very ape-like, yeah.
Okay.
I love street fights. I love fighting in general. The thing that people have to understand is there are so many different types of violence. So in jiu-jitsu, I'm not a martial arts guy who arrived at jiu-jitsu because I love martial arts. I'm a guy who loves fighting, and through my life, wrestling, fighting, MMA, jiu-jitsu is where I can now manifest the feelings and the things that make me want to fight. So I always, when I'm teaching classes, jiu-jitsu has changed a lot. And I'm constantly telling people that this is not about doing gymnastics while you're wearing a kimono. We are in a fight. Make no mistake about it. Anyone who tells you that this is not a fight doesn't know what a fight is. Yes, there's a fight, within a specific rule set. Anyone who tells you a jiu-jitsu match is a match, not a fight, I challenge them to define to me what a fight really is. Oh, do you need to get punched for there to be a fight? I've been in some very, very difficult wrestling matches that were much harder on me than any event where we're punching and kicking. So to what I tell those people is, then let's just talk about any event with a referee isn't a real fight then. People want to tell me that jiu-jitsu is not a real fight. I would put this challenge to them. Name an event with a referee that is a real fight. A referee exists to make sure that a real fight doesn't happen. That's why he's here.
Right.
He's here to make sure that a real fight doesn't happen, that I don't take you down and stand on top of you and kick you in the back of the head, right, that I don't fish hook you, that I don't eye gouge you, and I don't do all the things I need to do to make sure that you don't get up again.
Like I said, I'm well aware of my own fear. And the kind of fear I feel even in jiu-jitsu is way different than street fights.
Well, there's an unpredictable aspect to a street fight.
Completely. I mean, I don't know if it's even rational. I don't know if you can break it down. You're speaking very eloquently about street fighting. It's terrifying. Like everything. I guess it's the uncertainty of it. It's the
terrifying part of a street fight, other than the physical damage that can be done, it's very much a deeper issue. Street fighting is what's categorized as social violence. Violence that the outcome either reinforces or establishes a social order.
Right.
And so when you lose a street fight, you have now there's an inferiority thing going on there. You are not the superior being. When you win that street fight, you've established yourself as the superior person there. Those are social violence situations.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy.
Think that holds up still?
It only has to hold up in your mind.
Right.
That's the only place it has to hold up. Right.
Why does it have so much impact? Is that just a specific set of population that cares about violence? Or some kind of weird Neanderthal descendants?
I think at the end of the day, and I'll shut up in a second, but at the end of the day, I think we all care about violence and we suppress it. Like, many psychologists will tell you that there's the only true meaning to life is to pass on your DNA, right? And the two things that the two ideas that allow you to do that are sexual ideas and violent ideas, right? Those are the things that are going to allow us to most effectively pass on our DNA. And so sex and violence they're totally intrinsically tied. And people who try and separate like those things and say one's good here, one's good there, the violence is bad. Violence is not a bad thing. Violence is a great thing. Violence is cathartic. Violence is a way to, like I said, like social violence is a way to reestablish social hierarchies. If a bad person comes into a room and he's hell bent on violence, do you know what stops him? The only thing that stops that guy is the threat of more violence. Otherwise, he's just going to do what he wants.
Of course, with weapons, violence start having a different shape.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Social, like societal right. impact. Because like guns are easy.
Right.
So, like, you don't have the samurai. I mean, it's no longer has that
it's
dominance.
Less intimate.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if intimate is. I guess it's in.
I think.
But, like, if you shoot a bunch of people, I feel like you won't have the same alpha statement, socially speaking.
I always say that I think people who commit violent acts with weapons are the biggest cowards.
Right.
Because a weapon is entered into a violent situation and it changes the dynamic. No longer does that become a thing at the end of the violent episode where you've not necessarily established any sort of hierarchy because you've got a wild card involved. This is not Lex and John fighting and the winner, you know, controls the block here, you know, because, you know, someone introduced something that's foreign to the violent exchange, I guess. I don't know. I'm
right.
doing all this
just
on the
to
fly.
Clarify, you're not like threatening my block. Right?
No.
You're still good here.
Yeah.
Because I've actually established dominance over an entire central square of quite ease. Just yeah, by not being vegan.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
but anyway, like to get on the whole violence thing, like the fact that it's in vogue to shun violence in society now, it shows a lack of understanding of violence. There's a lack of
understanding.
Do you think
it's in vogue to shun violence?
I think it's in vogue.
I was going to say maybe violence is it's too like broad a term. I think maybe shunning violence in general is more okay than shunning like, I don't know, contact or something. That's too damp a term.
Right.
But you know what I mean? Somewhere in that, in between there.
Combat. So I think when you say violence, people think guns.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I
in
think
that regard, yeah.
That's
yeah.
the popular, right. yeah, that's where your mind is drawn now. And I use violence as just, you know, a more umbrella term. And yeah. now people, because people hear the words gun violence all the time. So we're naturally drawn to thinking of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, I have the same, I mean, to me, violence expands the realm of ideas too. So one of the things I also experienced here is a lack of aggression in terms of ideas. So people are really cautious, and I in academic circles, even in engineering, there's a like coming from maybe a Russian background where it's stylistically popular to say you're an idiot because you hold that belief, and let me show you why you're wrong, and it's almost a recreational like together we agree that we're gonna do. Hold different beliefs in this conversation in order to arrive at a greater truth. Mm. And that feels violent and aggressive and sometimes can get loud, but you really don't hold those beliefs. Like, it's not emotional. It's, yeah, it's violent. It's a creative violence. Like, the final result is a better idea. Yeah. And I find that everyone's really cautious here. In the same way that they're afraid of violence in terms of guns or whatever, they're afraid of being offended.
Well, we've weaned that out of people. We've weaned that aggression in America. All that's being weaned out. They're attaching so many bad words to every behavior now that people have to almost be these little wet noodles that are afraid to take a stand for anything, whether it's intellectual, physical, whatever it is, because they're afraid to like fulfill some stereotype that they don't want to be a part of. And it's an insecurity thing, and it's an identityless thing, and it's, you know, a total lack of fortitude on right. anyone's part. And that's why these people are going to get walked all over in every aspect of their life.
You're sort of preaching violence is a productive process of growth. But, you know, there might be people who don't like violence. They might want to discuss more calmly.
So social, one of the components and definitions of social violence is that there's always a nonviolent resolution that can be had.
Right.
So that's one of the components of social violence. You always can talk your way out of it. And that establishes the same thing at the end of the day. That same hierarchy should therefore still hold.
So words still have power and words have
right.
words can get you out of the actual.
Whereas asocial violence, that doesn't hold true.
Okay.
Asocial violence is like people like they'll kidnap you for ransom. They're trying to gain something out of the violent exchange, or process violence. Like for some people, the actual process of violence is what they're after. Those people can't be helped. That's not good stuff. That's not good stuff at all. That's the thrill-seeking muggers. Those are the rapists. Those are the serial killers. The process of violence is what turns them on, right? Those are the really bad things, asocial violence. But social violence, you know, under the right circumstances, isn't always a bad thing. Hmm. Lots of times it is.
So I have a lot of connections to Harvard. You can teach a course on the power of violence.
I would love to.
I kind of like the idea, and I think there's room for it. Speaking of violence, can you tell me what's your connection to Carlson Gracie Jr.?
My instructor, Fabio Arujo, who I trained with since like late 98, early 99, somewhere around there. And I got my black belt from him. He's a Carlson Gracie senior black belt.
Right.
So Carlson senior came and trained with us a bunch of times in the States, things like that. When senior died, Carlson Jr. took over the federation, all the affiliate gyms and all that other stuff. And Fabio, my instructor, is very much a purist in terms of jiu-jitsu. He does not care about the IBJJF. He doesn't care about competing. He cares about jiu-jitsu for fighting, and that's it. And so when I got to a point where I wanted to open my gym, I talked to him about it, and he said, just do a Carlson gym. Carlson Jr. now is running the federation. So I opened the Carlson Gracie affiliate gym in South Boston.
But there's definitely a culture that comes with it. Or is it just you? Is the culture of your gym, is there some echoes of a greater organization?
I was very fortunate in that the only jiu-jitsu gym that was open in Connecticut was a Carlson Gracie lineage gym because it matched perfectly my personality, which probably helped keep me involved in the sport. If when I was a young guy and I went to go find jiu-jitsu, I walked into like one of these other gyms where it's like, hey, my bro, let's get some acai and, you know, let's go barambolo and flow roll and stuff, I probably would have been totally sickened by the gym. But my very first jiu-jitsu experience was that we had purchased the 12 VHS volume, the 12 tape volume on VHS of the Baz Rutten grappling system. Mm-hmm. My old wrestling coach owns a restaurant. We matted the basement of the restaurant with old wrestling mats, covered them in camping tarp, and we watched these videos and tried to figure out with our wrestling how to get to these submission spots. The basement flooded. We started going and taking each other down in the park and fighting in the park and trying to figure these moves out. The jiu-jitsu gym opened. I walked in there and I saw Fabio, who's at the time, you know, he's like 5'11", 6 feet tall, but just rail thin, like, you know, 170 pounds at that height. And I had my wrestling shoes and I was like, this dude? And he spoke so little English that my first introduction to jiu-jitsu was we just slapped hands and fought. And I double-legged him and I picked him up. And on the way down, I was tapping to a triangle. And it was within 4 minutes of walking in a jiu-jitsu gym, I was like, this is fucking awesome. And if someone had brought me in and like told me to like barambolo underneath somebody and try and like take their back, my bro, I would have been like, fuck this, where's the wrestling club?
So you're caricaturing both, bro. So I'll tell you, like, I've been a part of several gyms, and one of my most where I've come up is Balance Studios in Philadelphia. And they're neither of those. Very easy. They're like, we'll love you whoever you are kind of atmosphere. And it just happens to have a lot of killers. Mm-hmm. Who are just sort of politely walking around, mm-hmm, and just destroying everybody. But it's not part of the culture to sort of this kind of military feel, which I personally connect with, like coming from wrestling, where there's like a coach that's like basically trying to beat out the weakness out of you. So that's what I kind of associated the Carlson Gracie senior, junior with a little bit. Like where there's a strong, like they want to make tough people out of you. That's
so that feeling. That outlook on jiu-jitsu, it 100%, it can't really exist anymore. Because so my gym that I came up in, August was Valetudo month, whether you liked it or not. And the idea of August was that all the weak students would quit. Or we just wouldn't see them for a month.
Right.
And they'd come back in September.
Right.
Either way, people were okay with that. The problem is that when I trained that way, there was only one gym in the state. So we're not making tough people anymore, right? You don't, as society evolves, there's no increase in tough guys being born. If anything, there are less. So when the tough guys all wanted to train, they all went to one gym because there was only one gym that existed. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to train, that's how you did it. Now, as there's literally jiu-jitsu everywhere, like in an urban setting like this, there's probably a jiu-jitsu gym, you know, within a half a mile from almost anybody's house. You can't teach that way. But what I try and do in the way that I teach is I will love everyone for who they are as long as they're honest about it. And like I'm not going to lie to someone and say, I'm not going to be a co-conspirator in someone's life who's all about lying about their training to put it on Facebook. I'm not co-signing on that. I'm not going along for that ride. So if you're honest about who you are, I will love you and I love your effort in jiu-jitsu. So long as you don't quit. My biggest thing is don't quit. Don't be a quitter. Because you're robbing from someone else their training time. But
wait, why are you robbing for someone else if you quit?
That's it's like tangential.
In the course of training,
don't be a quitter.
Oh, in the course of one training session.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Don't steal from your training partner.
Yeah.
But so for me, it's like I just want people to be honest about what their goals are in jiu-jitsu, and I want to help them to get there. I can't help someone to reach their goals if they're fucking lying about them. How can I help you as an instructor if you don't even know what your goals are?
Here's the thing. So let's go to the overpromise thing. So like you look at some – I mean I think there's quite a few folks like myself where the goals are fuzzy.
I think overpromising is a different thing than being a part of, lifestyle architecture through lies and social media. If yeah, you see the difference.
I think here's something you need to see a therapist about, is your relationship with social media.
Yeah.
Social media is bullshit. Who gives a shit? So what if you're lying to yourself in the same way you're lying to social media? Like, so forget social media. There is something disgusting about bragging on social media, you know, getting a medal when you're the only person in the division and bragging about that. Yeah, that's disgusting. But what's more concerning to me is, forget the social media part, that you to yourself lied like that.
Right.
Like, I very much enjoyed, so I try not to talk about it, but I enjoy losing when I really wanted to win. I sit there like depressed for a long time, and that depression from that grows like these complex goals of trying to, of growing, of realizing who you truly are. And I feel like that's a powerful thing for a coach to do.
100%.
Like, because I think a lot of people, even at your gym, a lot of tough guys are pussies.
Right.
And
you should, I just want to interject one thing.
Yep.
I believe this 100%. You should not be more dangerous on the mat than you are on the street. If you think that's you're a tough guy,
yeah,
and you're the place you're the most dangerous is in a very controlled environment like a jiu-jitsu gym, you are not a tough guy.
Right.
You should be most dangerous on the street corner when no one's looking. Your source of pride in being a tough individual, or like the things that define you being tough, shouldn't solely come from your effort and or results in a totally controlled environment like a jiu-jitsu training session.
So I think I can figure out what the follow-up is. Is, don't you think for most people that if they're learning good jiu-jitsu, obviously at some places they're not learning good jiu-jitsu, but let's say you are.
Let's name those places later.
That you'll you'll naturally just come about that. Like, how many people are there, I guess, where they're way more dangerous on the mat? It's not equal, street corner and mat.
I
don't you feel like the just learning and competing like on a day-to-day basis and like feeling the contact and stuff can make the person kind of equal in each?
I can't answer this question because I think we need some real psychological professionals, and also there needs to be some empirical evidence.
What do you say? What are you saying about Sean and I?
No, for all of us, for this topic, because so I've written a self-defense blog about self-defense because I don't believe in self-defense. I believe in self-awareness and self-offense. I believe that the minute the idea of defense in a real world situation has crept into your brain, you're playing from a step behind an inherent someone who might inherently be bad. And when you're in one of those situations, that's going to result in one of a number of things, whether it's social violence that's going to dictate a hierarchy or asocial violence where you could be killed, like a real world penalty there, not losing a match or something. I think that you need to be the person who strikes first all the time.
Yeah, so there's something appealing to your philosophy of the best way to suppress violence is through violence. And that's another extension of that is offense. Right.
But just to quickly go back to this idea. So my idea was that a legitimate jiu-jitsu blue belt, if you've trained in a legitimate academy, you should be able to handle in a socially violent situation, not asocial, because those people have weapons and they want to murder you. You're talking about the guy on the street who wants to beat you up. Given size and strength and athleticism are equal for this conversation, I would think that a jiu-jitsu blue belt who's trained at a regular gym or a real gym would have the skills to beat that individual. But I that was my theory as recently as a year ago. And now I just don't know if that's true. The idea is, I thought of a couple things. Like, as a blue belt, you should know an arm drag. You should know a double leg. You should know distance control, right? But there's another level there where I've seen people who are good in jiu-jitsu tournaments, and they can turn that level of aggression on while there's a referee there in a controlled environment. And they're very afraid to turn it on outside of that environment, because what happens when I turn my level of aggression up? Someone else turns their level of aggression up, and I might not be ready for that shit. And so therefore, I'm not sure that holds true anymore. I just don't know. I'm not taking a side right now.
Yeah, because there's no jiu-jitsu doesn't teach that.
Right.
Jiu-jitsu teaches technique.
Right.
I don't think jiu-jitsu teaches violence or being on offense or being
always
being able to be the leader of the violence.
So that's where my idea of awareness comes in. If I'm approached on the street and I'm a blue belt and I need to be aware enough of the situation to know that I should exit, right? Because in socially violent situations, there's always a nonviolent resolution. It's just not the one that's always taken. So I should be aware enough that I'm potentially entering a social violent situation and I should use my smarts or my mouth to get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the awareness level. When the awareness level has failed, and we're definitely going to lock horns here, that's where you have to think of, okay, I know some jujitsu. Maybe I'm not an inherently violent person or whatever, but like, and jujitsu doesn't teach you to be violent. Like, it's not like, you know, we're the bad sensei from the Karate Kid or something like that. Like, we're going to strike first. But it's, you should know enough about this situation that whatever happens here, I need to go first. If I can't keep this guy out of my personal space, I need to arm drag him and maybe foot sweep him. And the minute he stumbles, I can run, because criminals in general are lazy. They're not going to chase you or anything like that.
Yeah, but there's nothing about jujitsu. I mean, maybe your gym does that a little bit, but I don't know if that idea is taught or can be taught.
I don't know that it can be either, which is why I've backed off my previous opinion that a properly trained jiu-jitsu blue belt should be able to take on an evenly sized and athletic individual on the street. I think I'm backing off that now because I'm not sure. Again, I don't know. I'm not taking a camp here. I don't know that that can be taught.
I mean, one thing I experienced when training with you guys is there is a little violence, maybe anger, but not really unhealthy emotion. There's a kind of violence that I think is productive for a street fight.
Right.
Which makes me sometimes a little uncomfortable when that's exhibited by people who are less technical than me. And they're like imposing that violence.
Right.
But it makes me feel uncomfortable, but in a good way. Like
I feel like a lot of times when people talk about jiu-jitsu, and it seems to me like the camps get set up as being, on one end you have like the super smooth technical guys who are like kind of flowy and they don't feel like violent.
Yeah.
And then you have like the more violent you are, that means you're untechnical and stuff.
Right.
I feel like the very, very good jiu-jitsu practitioners, it's just both of those,
right,
those things, yeah, at
the
once.
The very best.
They're incredibly technical and everything is done correctly, but there's also like an edge to what they're doing.
There's like the technique that I always think about in the room that kind of sums everything up is a crossface, right?
Yeah.
A crossface. If you're afraid to crossface someone for whatever reason, so say you got like an overzealous blue belt, maybe he doesn't want to crossface Sean because he knows he's going to get blasted back twice as hard. Everything is a pendulum. Yeah. You push it hard one way, it's going to come back hard at you,
yeah,
right? Maybe you got a guy who doesn't want to crossface someone because he doesn't want to be mean to someone, whatever the case may be. But if you're unwilling to, like, you know, use a crossface for what it's meant to be used for in a grappling sport, you're probably getting your ass kicked on that street corner.
It's like this weird line you have to, because if everybody's cross-facing everybody, then you'll never develop the Keenan Cornelius technicality.
See, that I disagree. I think that's what I'm saying. I think that at a higher level, it's true that for the more like beginner level, the more spazzy and like violent you are,
right,
generally that the less technical you're probably
being.
When does
the beginner level end?
That's a good question. I don't know if you can like demark. It
feels like it ends at black belt for sure. Maybe not, but before black belt.
Yeah, I don't know. There is some switch that happens at some point. I don't know exactly when it is, and it's probably very different for everyone.
So if you watch a high level wrestler shoot a beautiful sweeping outside single and run the pipe, and at a really high level, that might look like it's not as violent. And that same guy now later in the match catches a double and just runs the double and blasts you, and it's a high amplitude takedown. Like, is there a difference in the level of violence? Is violence in the intent? Is violence in what it looks like aesthetically to other people? Because I think they're both really, really technical. It's just one comes off as more violent.
I think it's like a feeling,
yeah,
sort of thing.
It's a very small, subtle thing.
Yeah, it's a very, yeah, totally.
So I always tell the students that, like, especially when they begin to compete and stuff like that, I say, this is an opportunity to design what people are going to say about you. You can design your own image to a certain extent on the mat here. And what I mean by that is, especially like at the lighter belts, when you go to compete, you're going to compete as a four-stripe white belt or a blue belt or whatever, and you're probably going to go home and tell someone all about your day. And whether you gas it up or you tell, you know, or you underplay it, whatever the case may be, you're probably, if you had anything of note happen to you that day, you're going to talk about it. And so what I tell the students is, when you go out there, think about it. Think about what you want that kid to say about you. Think about who you want to be. How do you want to design your jiu-jitsu? Yeah. If you want to be the most technical guy, then that's what you have to go out there and be today. If you want that guy to go, oh man, the grips on this kid were unbelievable, he was so technical, you're the one in charge of that. If you want to go out there and you want to say, you know, you want that person to say, man, that guy was so fucking mean. Like, you're the one that's in charge of that.
I wish somebody said that to me. I mean, that's a really powerful way to see your, especially early competition. This isn't about like strategy required to win a match. This is how like you want the world to see you.
Right.
How you want everybody, yeah, yourself and everybody to see you.
Yeah.
And yes, I'm never playing guard again.
and I think that
a mean guard player.
Okay.
A lot of it has just to do with, like, to a degree, how that manifests is just through effort. So what I just want the guys to do is to continue to try. Don't kind of bail on what you're doing. I want them to just keep on trying. And, like, don't be forgotten. If the guy wins your division and he had four matches that day, like, he better fucking remember your match.
Yeah.
Make him remember your match. He doesn't have to remember the other three. But he better, in my opinion, like, what I want from my students is, I don't care if they win or lose the match, but my goal is that for every opponent that beats them, I want that opponent to walk away and say, I don't want to have to go through that again to win a match.
Yeah. This might be tangential, but it's related, is like that violent edge feeling versus not. I think when people try to be like aggressive, that's when they're not like not technical and they overextend. And it's right. Like if anger is a feature of their jiu-jitsu, you're constantly overextending and missing and being not as like efficient as you could be. But like the really good guys who like feel mean and tough, it's just part of what they've developed, because that's the nature of having to like grapple someone.
And I think effectively, I think we need to like, and clearly I'm not equipped to do it, we need to find the differences between violence and anger.
Yeah.
Because anger is an emotion. And it can manifest itself. And it's a secondary emotion, right? So it comes from some other primary emotion. And then the way that you manifest it or personify it or don't can be violent or not violent. I don't know. I think there's a lot to unpack in there.
I feel like anger helps unlock the door to violence. I think we all exist in a somewhat polite society,
yeah,
where violence, even confrontation, is difficult. And so anger sometimes required, just like alcohol is required to hit on a beautiful girl. Anger is required to find violence that is appropriate for a situation.
So I had this really long conversation, like probably after my third MMA fight. I have a great friend at home and he's a police officer now, but he is an unbelievably tough kid and he's been in a shitload of street fights. But the street fights that he's been in were, there was emotion behind him. Like there was a reason for getting in the fight. So he came up, I had fought here and I don't know. And he's a really violent kid. And he's like, I just couldn't do that. What you just did to that person. Like it was a little bit early in MMA, like early 2000s, they weren't very quick to stop fights. And so I remember like being mounted on a kid and just dropping elbows, like 12-6 elbows, like right on, cutting him open and then grinding my forearm in the cuts and trying to like spread the cuts across his forehead. And he's like, I couldn't do that unless that person did something to me. Like I need to like have an emotional connection to that, where I don't, because I think the emotional connection for me is like, there's a level of gratification I get out of doing that.
Yeah, but you're so past, like, you probably don't even remember how you've developed your relationship with violence.
I probably don't. No, I probably don't. I mean,
and there was probably a process.
Definitely.
Process. And I think that's the process actually people need to go through when they're first starting jiu-jitsu or other. I mean, yeah, it's a very healthy process.
Yeah.
I don't need to know that they need to go through that for jiu-jitsu, but I do in, like, my very, like, totally unrefined thought process about what I think people need to do in order to like learn about themselves. I think that every kid at some point in their life should, in the middle of the day, alcohol not involved, have to be in a fist fight. I don't think there's any other, like, more, there's not another tool that's as efficient in teaching you about yourself than that.
I'm in search of that tool as well, because I've heard myself say the problem with everyone in this room is that most likely none of you have been punched in the face. I've had this to students, and I'm not sure what I meant. It almost
that phrase is a vehicle for some other idea, but it gets it gets your point across.
It feels like I'm bragging about the fact that I've been punched in the face,
but it's not the particular thing. It's what comes along.
What's the better thing, right? Yeah. Like, what's the better?
Better articulate that idea.
What's another alternative? So if you're against violence, if you think violence is not a way to explore or grow as a human being,
you're wrong, first of all.
Well, I think it could be, like we were talking about mastery before, it could just be endeavoring really seriously to get good at something. Could be one option. But you have to be, like, serious about it. It can't just be like, oh, I'm going to tinker on the guitar
but here's the thing.
Couple times a week. I don't know.
What other discipline? I feel like the reason fighting works, maybe for males, is it's the first time you confront the fact that you're not who you thought you are.
For me, maybe. That's a good point.
And I don't know what other disciplines, if you take guitar seriously, I don't know if you can be delusional quite for a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't know what other endeavors there are.
I don't know. Yeah. I know what you're saying.
I mean, for me, I love using those analogies of street fights and stuff, but take the guitar analogy. I think, like, you practice this for so long, and the only way you find out where you really, like, live in that world is to make yourself vulnerable by getting involved in some sort of a display of that.
The vulnerability is a big piece. Right. I think in fighting or competition, like one-on-one competition, the vulnerability is the fact that you're accountable to the other person who's trying to take your head off always. And so there's no, like, escape. You can never kind of just, like, back away and say, actually, no, I'm done with this. Like, that's not an option.
And it's like we always talk about the difference between, like, sport and game. For the most part, in combat sports, there's generally, you know, there's a definite end to it. Although there are a handful of excuses and bad judges and this and that and the other thing. But, like, if you go out and you're a piano player and you go and you give a concert, 99% of the people aren't going to know that you missed one of those notes.
Right.
Whereas,
yeah, I think with, like, jiu-jitsu as the example, there's such clarity in some, like, another person who is your size or maybe even smaller can make you feel helpless. There's something, like, powerful about that. I don't know. I think of myself, though, I'm not like a street fight guy. So I don't know.
I think street fighting, so from my perspective, street fighting came from a place where I thought I was a badass. Mm. So it was a very helpful process to discover that. Like, first of all, obviously it helped me discover that I'm not a badass, but it also helped me redefine what badass means.
Mm.
And
Before
jiu-jitsu ever did. I mean, jiu-jitsu just helped continue that journey.
Right, right.
So, like, for me, street fights came from, like, when I was a little kid, like, living in an area where I was, where it was a very racially diverse area, and I was one of the only white kids there, and so the older kids in the neighborhood would pick on me. Yeah. This kid, Alberto, used to beat me up when I would go up to De Palma's Market with my mom's money, and she'd send me up there with, you know, the $20 bill or whatever it was to get cold cuts and trash bags. Alberto lived next door to De Palma's, and he would take my fucking money and beat the shit out of me every single time I went in there. I'd go home with nothing. And my mom would beat the shit out of me because she thought I spent the $20 on Doritos and Fun Dip and ate it on the way home. Yeah. So I just couldn't win. Yeah. So, and then later in life, I went to a private school where kids were very financially much more it was very materialistic. I wasn't used to that world. Right. And these kids were smart and all, you know, they're all getting, you know, wearing all the new clothes and stuff. And I was very insecure. And I remember that I got into a fight at private school when I was in sixth grade and it, like, totally scared to death for my life. And just from beating up one kid in private school, all of a sudden the girl started talking to me and I learned no, I'm serious.
I see that coming. Okay.
And
okay, so it helped you find your manhood.
I'm not going to, like, be that, like, grandiose about it, but I'm going to tell you that I learned an unfortunate lesson as a young kid. And I can look back on it and understand it now, is that, like, who doesn't want girls to talk to you? Like, I went from one day, none of the girls talking to me, to beating a kid up, to all the girls talking to me. Yeah. So, you know, and nothing else in my life changed.
Do you
so
think the girls knew, or is it the thing in your...
No, everyone knew. Everyone knew. It was a big deal in the school.
Are you sure it's not... You change like somehow?
A confidence sort of
thing. That might be, it but might, what I can tell you is that I took I from that point on, whether it's conscious or subconsciously, I was sure that I was not walking away from a fight that, you know, I thought could get more girls to talk to me. So I learned an awful lesson at that age,
yeah.
And so that like contributed to the way I behaved, you know, for a great many years.
Yeah, I think a similar story to Bruce Lee. He talks about he got into fighting because he gets so much pussy. Yeah.
Well,
yes, that's not at all. I've never heard articulated in that way.
I mean, this might be a topic for another podcast, but I don't believe that there's any action on some like deep seated level that isn't directly related to our efforts to get laid.
Oh, boy, it's it
all this time like, doing jiu-jitsu. I don't know if that
it's somehow connected.
It's connected. It's in there.
Connected.
Okay. It's in there.
So there's a guy named Ernest Becker, I think. I read his book a long time ago, Fear of Death. So another theory. So one is everything you do is to get laid. Another is we have this deep fear of our mortality, and which I find that most people, especially tough guys, are totally ignorant of their fear of death.
Did he talk about like the construction of cities and stuff as a way for us to like stave off our fear of death? Was that him?
Yeah. So everything is under everything else. Like Freud thinks you want to have sex with your mother. He thinks everything is about you trying to escape the fact
the that reality
you,
of
your... that you're going to this thing is going to end for you soon enough. And so that's something I was kind of connected with because to me, life doesn't make any fucking sense. Because of this one thing. I mean, it's all going to end pretty soon. And it's kind of a fascinating idea.
But would it make any more sense if it just went on to infinity? I feel like either way.
Well, no, it doesn't make sense at all. It doesn't make any sense. So, like, it doesn't... Like, what is life? Why does it end? What happens after it ends? If you start trying to picture in the same kind of way, okay, if you go to a tournament and it ends, you're going to get some food... And then you might get laid and there'll be a mourning.
Yeah, right.
But like it's over. Hopefully. This is the last turn. Hopefully. It depends who you get laid. But there's a mourning. And if you die, that's it. That was the last tournament ever. That was your last. That's it. And it's intellectually confusing. And it feels like we're not grappling with that fact at all.
So
like global we.
Globally, individual on the individual level, it feels like we're constantly living in ignorance of, just totally clueless about. Because you're kind of walking about every day thinking about like, okay, what do I want from life?
Right.
What do I want? And the want is not grounded in any kind of because it's all for nothing.
So what I always think about when I think about like mortality and stuff, and like as I'm. You know, I'll probably never have any offspring. I'm the last person with my last name. So, like, I'm going to definitely get old by myself, most likely, which is cool. I'm fine with that. But what I always think about...
Are you sure of this? By the way, that's a third podcast.
Yeah, that's a third one. I think that, like, for me, it's not about being afraid to, like, die or anything. I mean, that's going to be a scary time when you approach that. But right now, what I try and do is, like, I try and use up every minute to do something awesome so that I don't regret any time. Like, I don't want to look back and be like, oh man, I was, you know, playing fucking Ark 3, you know, all my video games or whatever. When what I could have been doing was experiencing other things, like with other people, whatever it is, whether it's for me, it's jiu-jitsu or I enjoy drinking beers. I like music. I like to travel, stuff like that. Like I have no money. Right. Because I make money, but I spend every penny I get doing something that makes me happy right now.
But see, that's admirable, and I feel like some of the more enlightened people think of this way, but I still they think, like, I'm not afraid of death because if I live life to the fullest, then, like, what am I afraid of, really? Like, what else, like, why be afraid of it?
I don't think it's about not being afraid of death or, like, living life to the fullest, because I think that when death really starts to come knocking on your door and you know your time and you really know your time is finite, like, I think that's going to be scary no matter what. But what I don't want to do is spend that time regretting what I didn't do. So that's another component of the fear of death.
So you're removing that one unpleasant property of daily life when you're close to death is regretting shit.
Right. Right. Jamie, can we get the Hunter S. quote about dying? I'm going to pull that up.
Yeah. On that note, let me take a break. I'm going to take a piss break.
Life should not be a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, wow.
Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah.
Like,
fucking amazing. I'm drawn to that. That's fucking awesome.
Right.
But that's also intellectually dishonest.
How so? About not disagreeing.
Nature of existence.
Yeah.
You're ignoring completely. But why is that so appealing? You're saying I'm going to ignore the essence of reality of it, trying to think about what is life.
There's an attempt to live your life in a way for some people. And I'm not saying, and this is a guess because I don't think I'm one of these people. I think like there's an attempt to live your life in such a way that when death comes, you almost welcome it. Fuck, I'm so tired of doing all this shit. Maybe it's like.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just a guess. I've never like read anything about that or studied that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something really appealing to folks who've lived a full life and they're like a badass full life. And they're like, I guess I'm just tired.
Yeah.
And they're like ready to go.
And also, like, some people die at the end of like being sick for a really long time.
Yeah.
And you just get tired of fighting whatever that is.
Right.
And then usually people that get a really deep, fulfilling relationship with their wife die shortly after the wife dies.
Right. And that's gone. So like whatever reason you had for continuing is no longer there.
So you've decided finally that you, John, are going to miss out on this wonderful sharing of identity
as
marriage.
So I think that I won't miss out on that. And I think that I'm having this wonderful sharing of identity right now.
Right.
And,
yeah.
It's I think it doesn't exist. Like,
I think people desire like belonging and companionship is a very broad thing. Right. I think we've kind of traditionally we've kind of put it into marriage being the main one. That's not the only way to experience companionship and belonging and whatever.
And there are dialectical tensions that exist in each human being, and I think there are seven main dialectical tensions, which are like these opposing ideas that coexist simultaneously. The most common one is security and autonomy. So people, by nature, we crave both of those things at the same time, and you just like unless they're constantly in a state of flux and you can balance that and live that way, like that's fine. But some people like one outweighs the other. Yeah. And for a lot of people, they'd rather have the security than the autonomy. I'm an autonomy guy. Like,
right. Everyone probably kind of tends toward one side of the spectrum on those things. Right.
It doesn't mean you don't crave whatever the security is, whether it's the security that someone will be there tonight when you get home, or whether it's the security that for some people it's a financial security.
Yeah.
It's just like a human touch or whatever that can be. Like, people crave that. And I think that a lot of those people are like, they simultaneously crave that, and they're also afraid of like being by themselves. And so then they wind up in these relationships for the wrong reasons. Mm. And I think a lot of people aren't strong enough to just be like, I don't need another person to like make my life whole.
So what do you think like romanticism is? Like being romantic with another person?
I think that you can be romantic with another person, but you got to go in knowing that everything dies and that relationship is not permanent. Those feelings that you have in the beginning are great. But if you go into it knowing that, hey, all that stuff is going to wear out. All that's going to go away in time. And do you remain in that, like what now is basically a partnership, right? Because now you're, you know, all that other stuff probably is gone. Like that feeling you had. So there are like 9 phases, I think, to like a romantic relationship. And the termination phase is always the longest. So I think they call it the elation phase, which is like the very second phase. It's the cloud 9 phase.
Yeah.
Where like
the
the honeymoon phase. Like, can you text me? Because I don't think my texts are working because she hasn't texted me. Like that phase.
Yeah.
Like that dies out. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you go through all these other phases and stuff. And I think when that's over, you're enough of a psychopath to be like, I need to go find that again somewhere. The chemical reaction here is over.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, there's a Louis C. Kevin, if you watch that show, Louis. There's a, like, Louis is walking around, you know, Louis C. Kevin, the comedian. Yeah, he's walking around and just like, you broke up. He's in the termination phase again.
Yeah.
Which is when it's after it's over.
They say like the termination phase begins the minute anyone even mentions the word breakup. You can even say it as a joke, and they say clinically that starts the termination phase.
Interesting.
Oh. You are now in that phase.
So he said that that's, he was, this old man was telling him, why are you so depressed? Because this is the best part. Like, missing her because it's over is the best part. As it's the worst part is when you've forgotten about her and you no longer care. So the best part is this, the years when you're like remembering this person, like the heartbreak. This is something I remember that always caught me like, yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Because you're actually like feeling something.
Feeling, yes, like, I believe that, yeah.
If you're feeling something.
Right.
It's interesting. But because I come from like, the question is relationship part of, you know, how you were raised? Because in Russia, for example, people don't get divorced or didn't get divorced. Like, I was raised in a culture where like it is monogamous and relationships work, and there's a over the top romantic element that is kind of like the Hunter S. Thompson. Because right now, what you're doing, while admiring the Hunter S. Thompson live to the fullest, fucking guns blazing, go crazy, you're also very logically breaking down the concepts of relationship into nine phases and saying that as long as you're aware that it's over. But that's not the Hunter S. Thompson way. Hunter S. Thompson way is go all in and fucking every aspect of it, just live it.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't try to break it down. Like, almost ignore like the fact that you're going to die, or ignore the fact that relationships end, and just fucking live it.
Well, and I think that it's important, like, when you're in a relationship, like, I'm not saying, like, you shouldn't be in relationships. You just got to approach it like, yeah, go all in, but know that at some point it ends.
No, see, but you're saying, you said just now that, I mean, part of it is jokingly, but you're saying you're not going to be in a relationship, you're not going to have offspring. Why is that so certain for you?
If I said that I won't be in a relationship, then I probably misspoke, because I don't mean that.
No, I mean like,
I mean like in terms of having kids. Number one, we talked about knowing what kind of asshole you are. Well, I'm a selfish asshole.
I'm
a
selfish
part. And for me, I see kids as something that will 100% take away from the way that I have designed my life. Almost nothing's a mistake. I'm here doing this right now in my torn up jeans and my Chucks on a Sunday night because I've created my life a certain way, and this is the way I want it. Yeah. And I see kids as something that the it's a benefit. It's a, what the kid will give, it's perceived because I don't have a kid. Yeah. So what that kid will provide me, it doesn't measure what it will take away from me. It'll take too much away from what I like versus what it will provide me.
It feels like that's a logical argument, though.
Right.
That I don't know should be applied to life.
Right. Like, the logic will break down almost always, which is the Hunter S.
Like, you should probably kill yourself if you fully pursue the logic.
Right, if you follow it. If you're coming from a place of, like, no, there's no foundational, like, value system, and you're just trying to go from point zero to figure it out.
What you should do today, if you're trying to say, if you're trying to find the reason for doing anything, I feel like you're going to be hard, if you're being honest, you won't really find a reason to do anything.
That's like, very philosophical and long term.
Yeah.
I think, like, when I look for reasons to do stuff, the first, first thing is like, am I going to have fun? Is that going to put a smile on my face? Am I going to enjoy that? There are necessary evils all the time.
You're an existentialist.
Like, yeah, I'm 100%. I believe that. And I believe that, like, anything, time is our most scarce resource. And anything that I'm dedicating a minute of my time to that doesn't make me happy is something I want to avoid at all costs.
That's, yeah. I guess my devil's advocate thing for that is that it's very like hedonistic to just follow what will make you feel good. And then the question is that, I guess if you're just going moment to moment and you always feel good, then you're happy or whatever you want to call it. But like, overall, is that a good kind of map to follow?
Well, it doesn't
work. Underlying, like, value system.
It doesn't work. I mean, there are millions of things you have to do that you don't want to do.
I guess that's what I mean, right? Like, one way to look at it is, like, it would feel good to, like, do a bunch of drugs or something. But you can't just do that every single second, because that's, you're not.
Right.
That's not an appropriate way to live.
I think for me, like not being a drug guy, I like to drink my beers, but I'm not a drug guy. But I think that like I do a pretty good job of trying to do only the things. There's nothing that I want to do that I think will make me feel good that would break the law by me doing so. All the things I want to do are within the bounds of law for the most part. And so you can't really just be like, every minute I'm here, it's going to be to do something like that makes me feel good.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That doesn't hold up. Like
so now you talk about sacrifice, right? And especially when it comes to relationships, that's where the sacrifice comes in. Like, do you want to spend time at like your girlfriend or your mom, or your girlfriend's mother's house or something like that? Like, where is the cost benefit in that? Like, you know,
right.
Yes. It's probably not the way you want to spend those minutes of that day, but you're
trading it for something better later.
But what if you're trading it for just not getting yelled at about not going?
Well, then that's something you got to confront.
Right.
That's the
right.
No, that's legitimate.
Right.
Yeah, it's absolutely legitimate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if what you're doing is you're saying, okay, we're going to go to your mother's house, right? And you know, I don't really care for her, whatever the case is. And I'm doing this because next week you're going to come with me to my cousin's house, you know, and I know you don't really want to do that. So that's a pretty fair trade. Mm-hmm. But what if it's, I don't want to go here. I can't think of anything that is going to be a fair trade. And the only reason I'm really doing it is because I don't want to get in an argument right now.
See, here, I have a huge problem with that because I don't know if you're talking specifics or it feels like it a little bit, but I feel like I've, and I'm totally, I sound like a horrible person because
for the record, I don't dislike any of my,
of course not.
Right. No, I like anyone I've been in a relationship with, their mother's probably awesome.
Yeah, no, probably. You're speaking hypothetically for other mothers of other people you've been in a relationship with. I feel like when you start negotiating in this way, over the years, you totally demasculate yourself in relationships. Like, there's some weird, okay, honey, yes, honey, that happens. I'm just curious about it because you just brought this up. I've never been in a relationship longer than, like, 3 years. So I don't know. Is that a natural thing that's supposed to happen over the years?
There are groups of people that I really just dislike, like the jersey-wearing little nerds. And, like, the other group of people I really dislike are the guys who are in relationships that form this weird group with other guys in relationships. And it's, like, this, like, self-crafted, defeatist group of guys who are, like, I guess the women are going to take us to dinner tonight. Or, like, oh, the women are going shopping. Like, you know, and it's,
I
like...
I think that's, like, symptomatic of something else where it's, like, you're just... I don't know, maybe we're just circling back to the stuff we were talking about before, where you're not just trying to just be something like better than you currently are.
Right. I think the overarching theme here is that all these people we've been talking about are weaklings.
Yeah, but at the same time, I look, okay, maybe you're strong, but I look at myself and I'm constantly plagued by the thought that I'm a weakling. And like that's
I don't mean a physical weakling. I don't mean physically.
Wait, I'm sorry. What do you say? You know how much I bench? Just to clarify for the record, I bench a lot. No, I mean like just emotionally and psychologically. I feel like I'm constantly.
Right.
Like
my day, but doesn't that propel you to then go try and not be?
Yeah, that's my whole life.
Right, but that's the whole point is that.
Yeah, but I just feel like everybody's a weakling.
In some way. I mean, people
So I don't know if you can... I guess you're saying that if they don't strive... I don't know what it means to not be weakling within a relationship in such a way that you still maintain your identity. Mm. So over the years, if you can be 30 years into a relationship and still have a very powerful identity and yet have a deep connection with another human being, I don't know what that looks like.
I think that's a really delicate dance because after a certain amount of time... people, they begin to be identified as the couple. The individual is now identified as a couple. And so to be able to maintain your individualism totally after, you know, 15, 20, 30 years, that's a real trick. And I don't know a lot of people that have pulled that off. It's not that everyone wants to do that. Maybe people don't want to do that. But I know that, like, for me, like, I'm a big worlds colliding person. And like part of maintaining my individuality and identity when I'm in a relationship is that sometimes there are doors that are closed to people. I'll close off, you know, doors to other parts of my life because I feel like if that person creeps into that door, then that part of my life that I keep just for me it now is not just for me, and I'm a little bit of my identity is gone, and now I begin to slowly be identified as a couple, which I don't want to be. And so
I think I disagree with the like characterization of identity as being something that you've created yourself. Everyone is like contextual among all these other individuals. So like it's true that sometimes people are in a relationship and then they get like characterized as just those people and nothing else. But I think maybe the more healthy way that it would happen is like they're their people, but then also kind of that gets like mapped on is as being like that couple or whatever, plus a million other things that forms their identity.
And when I say identity, I probably shouldn't have said like that I've created. I mean, because your identity is totally relative.
That's what I mean. Right. I guess when you say like individualistic, like no, people are individuals, but they're also so like kind of tethered to all these different things.
Right. I guess I want to be the arbiter of what parts of my life are shared with who. And when you open every door of your life to someone, like you're no longer the arbiter of that, because those people, when you open a door, your girlfriend inevitably walks in and makes other relationships with other people in that world. And you begin to slowly lose control of that part of your life and they take it over. But also now, probably we're going to have to get a shrink in here, I think.
Yeah. I know. Your formulation of all this is very antagonistic. Like the other side, that nothing good can happen from the open doors. You seem to think that like only bad things would happen. It's somehow that like
just because statistically bad things happen.
Right. Statistically bad things happen. Like the ultimate open door, like, so let's go back to this topic. I think,
and also by the way, I'm a Worlds Collide guy too, but I'm just trying to
right. This is just this
figure
is,
out what
you don't
what
sound like Worlds Collide type of guys though. Which one? Give me an example of a time you allowed worlds to collide in your life.
My very best friend, he can go into, because he's like, you know, I've known him my whole life. There's not a door of my life that's close to him. Like he can, and he can fit into all those doors. And I know that there will be never an issue with it. Okay. I think that the ultimate open door, to go back to this, is social media. And so the ultimate open door on social media causes so many problems. And again, I don't have a personal page, but I've heard this. I've seen this happen. Your girlfriend now has access to everything that's going on. And maybe someone that you knew 20 years ago, like became your friend on Facebook and decided to like a picture, or you made a comment. It's so easily misinterpreted that I've seen more people get in arguments about a stupid like on a Facebook picture that someone they haven't seen in 20 years made. Like that's the ultimate open door worlds colliding situation right there. And it's misinterpreted. And then it's just like, so you know what? You close that door by not having social media. Like you don't even get involved in that.
You try and the other people, everyone has to be just more reasonable and not be.
I think
that's not, some people just aren't. So,
and people aren't reasonable. That. And also it's like, you know, we're all creatures of hormone and our hormones fluctuate based on what we eat. If we exercise, did we drink, what time of the month it is for both men and women. And it's about what were the circumstances where that message was received? Like, did you just have a great meal and you're happy and like, you know, whatever, and you saw someone like the picture on Facebook, you probably don't care. But if you're hungry, they show that what time of day you receive news changes how you perceive it. Like, all that stuff matters. And so to say that the other people should be rational is a great altruistic, like, idea.
Not even rational, just reasonable.
Reasonable.
I guess, yeah, that's missing words probably. I get what you're saying.
So on that note, I encourage people, if you're still insane enough to be listening to this, to go like Carlson Gracie Ball.
Broadway Jiu-Jitsu and Fitness.
Broadway Jiu-Jitsu and Fitness on Facebook. Especially if you're a hot chick because you need to make somebody very jealous.
Well, the Carlson Gracie page is private. You have to be a friend of a friend.
Okay, a friend of a friend. Yeah. Okay. Broadway Jiu-Jitsu on Facebook. And Sean, you're pretty private on Facebook, actually.
Yeah, I'm private in general.
Yeah, private.
Yeah. But I'm at Broadway Jiu-Jitsu training, so come and say what's up.
Yeah.
All right, awesome. Thanks for talking today, guys. And thanks for putting up with the bullshit of the mics and everything.
Yeah. There'll be a shrink on the next one.
So. I'm looking forward to it.